stuff that I find very exciting. So as Lee said, I'm going to talk about the Great Plague of London, which is one of the most famous epidemics of all time. But before doing that, I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to orient you a little bit more broadly about what I think is a very exciting project that I've started working on in the last couple of years. And that's connected not just with the Great Plague of London, but with mortality records in London, England, in general. And there are a lot of things that we can learn from these mortality records, and I hope that by the end of the talk you'll be convinced that's true. And in particular, we can learn a lot about epidemiology, about the spread of infectious diseases in particular. So why would we do this? Why would we be interested in studying in this area, which is the general area is studying the ecology and evolution of infectious disease? And there is a very obvious reason why we might want to do that, which is what might come to your mind immediately. And that's because there's public health significance to doing so. So if we can understand better epidemics that have occurred in the past, maybe we can learn enough to design better control strategies for epidemics that might occur in the future, or for controlling or eradicating disease that we have around us at the moment. There's another very important purpose, which is sort of more fundamental science, and that's to do with ecology. So you're probably aware that there are a lot of people in the world who study ecological systems, ecosystems, in order to just understand their dynamics and how they change from all sorts of perspectives. For example, people try to understand food webs, or more simply, predator-prey systems, and they go out and collect data on predators and prey and so on. But there's a fundamental challenge there. Although important and interesting, the data that one can collect on those systems is very restricted in the sort of breadth and depth that you can get. And that's the opposite for human infectious diseases, because there have been records kept over many, many years about incidence and mortality from infectious disease. And keep in mind that an infectious disease circulating in a population is just an example of an ecological system. You have a host, humans in the case that I'll talk about, and a parasite, whether that's some virus or a bacterium or a protozoan or anything else, which is living off the host. And what we have from the kinds of records that I'll talk about is an extraordinary example of data that describe host-parasite interactions. And we can learn a great deal about that, which we might be able to infer things from in order to understand ecology more generally. And so in particular, you can imagine a predator-prey system. If a typical predator, say a lynx, is looking for its favorite prey item, which might be a hare, if it doesn't find a hare, it might look for some other prey item. But with an infectious disease, that's not the case. If I have measles and all of you are immune to measles, measles doesn't go around looking for another host to infect suddenly. Such events can happen, but they're rare. It's very different from the typical situation in ecology. And consequently, we have a much more closed system that we're more likely to be able to model effectively. And that's very important if we're trying to get to the bottom of things with simple models that we can understand. OK, well, I'm a mathematician. What can I do to contribute to this field? And there are a couple of things that are important that one can do only with mathematical and computational methods. One is to quantify the transmissibility of a pathogen using the sorts of data that I'll describe. And we can do that either by connecting the transmissibility to the final size of an epidemic, or by estimating the growth of an epidemic. And I'll come to that later on. And estimating transmissibility is extremely important for any pathogen, precisely because we'd like to know how serious it's going to be, what the final size will be, how many people will be infected or killed, and exceedingly important for determining an optimal control strategy. Much more transmissible pathogens need to be dealt with in a different way than weakly transmissible pathogens. So another thing that we can do is just try to, in general, demystify the dynamics of epidemics, understand the role of seasonality in driving epidemic patterns, try to predict the frequency of epidemics that recur, try to understand the spatial structure of epidemics, and also evolution of pathogens and potentially evolution of hosts, and how that plays out in the long term in epidemiological dynamics. So I'm going to focus now, for most of the rest of the talk, on a particular epidemic, and that's the Great Plague of London. And this is work that I've been doing together with a former postdoc of mine, Junling Ma, who is now an assistant professor in mathematics at the University of Victoria. So the Great Plague occurred in 1665, and there are a few outstanding questions which may surprise many of you. One is that it's actually not clear what the pathogen was that caused this epidemic. And if you've heard anything about it, then you've probably heard that it was caused by bubonic plague. But in fact, that was an idea that was suggested by 19th century historians. And we don't have exceedingly strong evidence to support the idea that it really was bubonic plague. Bubonic plague is a disease that spread from rats or other rodents, typically, to humans via fleas. There's another form of the same bacterium that causes bubonic plague called pneumonic plague, which can be spread human to human, and that's called pneumonic plague. And so it might have been pneumonic plague still caused by this bacterium, Yersinia pestis, but it might have been spread human to human. Okay, those are things we don't know the answer to. Maybe we can get at by careful analysis. Another thing is that it has the reputation as being extraordinarily transmissible. People were extremely frightened if you read records at the time, and clearly had the sense that things were taking off very quickly. Was it really transmissible? How does its transmissibility compare to transmissibility of pathogens we're more familiar with today, like influenza? I'll come to that. And could we control this pathogen if it arose today? And something medical people are always asking me is, well, is this really relevant today? I mean, it's sort of fun to understand things that happened in the past, but does it really matter? Well, if it was bubonic plague that caused this epidemic, then it's extremely relevant, because plague caused by this bacterium, Yersinia pestis, is considered to be a major bioterrorist threat. So if we can understand better how it spread in London a long time ago, we might be able to learn things that would be relevant if it were introduced now into modern human communities. But I think it's exciting to study for its own sake, just to better our understanding of this host parasite system as well. Okay, so I'm going to orient you a bit, tell you about where this plague occurred. I'll talk about the sources of data that we have, that we've used in order to be able to describe the epidemic. Tell you something about the temporal pattern of the epidemic, and then the spatial pattern of the epidemic, and then at the end, I'll talk a bit about how we've estimated the transmissibility of this pathogen and exactly what I mean by that. Okay, so where did it occur? Well, it occurred on this island, which is no doubt familiar to you, in the southeast corner of this island. And if we blow that up, here we have an aerial view of modern London. And you can see the Thames River. This gives me an opportunity to use this hockey stick, but I shoot left, so I'm not sure it'll be quite appropriate. So here's the Thames, and you can see modern London around the Thames. The area of London that was relevant in the middle of the 17th century was much smaller, so we'll blow that up again, and here we have an aerial view of this section of modern London. And just to orient you, what I've marked here is the Guildhall manuscript section of the Guildhall Library, which is where we did our field work, essentially. That's the library where the records are stored that allowed us to digitize what happened during that epidemic. And in case you're familiar with London, here are a few other points that you might be familiar with: London Bridge, St. Paul's Cathedral, the Tower of London, Buckingham Palace. And it's even, so it's the very core of central London, and it's even a smaller section of this, which was only a couple of miles across, which constituted the city of London at that time. But of course, it didn't look anything like this in 1665. It appeared a lot more like this. This is a nice sketch of London at the time, and I'll just expand a couple of points here. So here's St. Paul's Cathedral as it appeared at the time, but it doesn't look anything like that now because it burned down in 1666 in the Great Fire of London. The other point of interest is London Bridge, which, and if you've been to London Bridge, it doesn't look like that now. In fact, if you've seen classic photographs or paintings of London Bridge, if you go back to the 19th century, it was a lovely pedestrian bridge. Now it's a very ugly structure. But in 1665, it was a beautiful covered bridge on which people lived. And the fact that people lived there might be relevant to some of the dynamics that we'll discuss. So I'll come back to that a bit, perhaps later. OK, so that's where it occurred. Now, how do we actually find out in detail what happened? Well, there are, as I mentioned at the beginning, some remarkable records that we have got access to. So here is an example of a photograph of one of the weekly bills of mortality for the city of London. And the date is written, and you probably can't read this from where you are. Maybe some of you can. So it's from the week beginning the 26th of September, 1665. And there are two panels here to this bill of mortality. On the left is a list of diseases and the number of people who died from those diseases in that given week. And I've circled the most impressive one. But I'll just actually point out a few more. So for example, there was consumption. I need my hockey stick again. There are many amusing ones. Consumption, which we assume was tuberculosis. 99 people died from consumption. You can see somebody died of grief. One person died of being frighted to death. And there are a number of entertaining causes of death here. But the one that I'm going to focus on is plague. This was in the middle of the Great Plague. 5,533 people died in a city of 500,000 in 1 week from plague. And just to get the idea of the magnitude of that, the number of people christened, so a good lower bound on the number of people born in that week, was 146. So this was a very devastating event. Yes?
500,000 people in London at that time?
Their demographers have estimated that, so that's a rough estimate.
I guess really my question at the level is what are the error bars on that number? Like, is it believed to be?
Well, it's a good question. Estimating the population size isn't something that I've tried to do myself, but the sort of error bars that people put in are something like 10%. Just how much weight you want to put on that, I don't know. Yes.
Who is responsible for collecting this data and how they do it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The each parish. So let me just actually go over the right side, and then I'll, and on the other. So this is for the whole city. The number of people who were who died of various causes, at least, or were attributed to various causes. On the right hand side is a list of the 130 parishes of London, and the number of people who died in each parish, and also the number of people who died from plague in that week. So we have a detailed spatial record in this tiny area, a couple of square miles in diameter, where we divide it into 130 regions. So we have a great spatial record. Now, what happened was that deaths, there were individuals who went around looking at those who died and categorizing what they were and before they were buried. Each parish collected the detailed records of their each individual was named, and then a summary was sent to some central body in London who put it together into this sort of table. I'm not sure that really answered. Sorry, it was answered.
Was this a typical week?
This was.
This is enough to kill everybody in a year.
This was not the worst week of the epidemic, but a bad week. I'll show you. You'll get a flavor for that. It was plague, by the way, that inspired people to keep these records carefully. Exactly why, I'm not sure. But in 1592 is when when there was a serious plague. It was the first time they started doing systematic weekly recording of these things. Now, this is a particularly good bill of mortality that's nice and clean and printed. Most of the records don't look like that. Most of them look like this. So they had a weekly bill, and then there are handwritten numbers in each of various categories. Fortunately, the handwriting is typically exceptionally clear. So we can read these numbers very easily. It doesn't mean, though, that we would be hopeless to use optical character recognition or other fancy tools to do the data entry for us. So I had an army of mostly undergraduates doing this kind of work. Anyway, at least we typically have an extremely reliable data entry process. Okay, so we enter all the data into a nice spreadsheet. What pattern do we see? And before I show you the Great Plague itself, I'll just show you other data that we've been digging out on earlier plague epidemics to orient you a bit. So you will have heard about the Black Death in 1348. I managed to find a source that had monthly mortality in London in the 14th century. So you can see there were three major plague epidemics in the 14th century. Just how complete this record is, I don't know. But it certainly indicates that something happened in these years. Where we start having, then there's a large gap until 1592, when we have pretty good records. So from 1592 onwards, we have good weekly records. And this shows plague deaths in London over that period. And the great plague that we're going to focus on is this one right at the end. And there were three other major plagues in the 17th century. One was in the 16th century. And although they seem to get bigger over time, in fact, each of them killed approximately 20% of the population. It's just that the population of London happened to be growing very rapidly during this time. And the Great Plague was the greatest plague, really only because the absolute numbers were largest. And we have by far the best data. We don't have the detailed parish data for these earlier plagues, unfortunately. But there were other things going on here. There were periods where there were recurrent smaller epidemics of plague, and it would be nice to understand exactly what the reasons for those are. And those are things that we might be able to address with mathematical modeling as well. OK, so let's blow up this final region of the Great Plague and see what that looks like. So here are the weekly deaths attributed to plague throughout 1665 and 1666. And I've also marked the weekly births, just again to emphasize just how devastating this epidemic was compared to the typical birth rate. So what can we do with this curve? What kinds of things might we be able to learn from? Oh, sorry, that's number of weeks since the first data point, which is the end of December 1664. But I've marked months.
The total ration was from May to December. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So what sort of things might we ask? Can we reliably estimate the transmissibility of the pathogen from this epidemic curve? So the speed at which it takes off is something that might tell us about the transmissibility. But can we do that from this aggregated curve? It's just aggregated over the whole city, or does it hide some details that are important? If this was enough for us to estimate the transmissibility, then we'd be assuming implicitly that the population was homogeneously mixed on that scale. Maybe that's reasonable on a scale of 2 miles, It's not clear. And another question that we'd like to know, which is related, is, I mean, did the disease become evident in all parts of the city simultaneously? Because if it didn't, then there must have been, there was some kind of spatial spread. And if there was spatial spread, that would make us worried about using this kind of curve to estimate transmissibility. Yes?
Is the apparent dip in the births real? And is it related to births that would have happened had the mothers not died?
I don't know. I've wondered that myself, but I don't have any. I don't have anything that will really answer that. It's also possible that reporting of births was poor during the plague. So.
Did people leave the city during the plague?
Pardon me?
Were people leaving the city during the plague?
There were. The wealthy left to, if they could, there were many wealthy people who left and went and lived in their country homes until and wrote out the plague. The proportion of the city that actually succeeded in leaving, I don't think was all that high. And that, I don't think that really had a big effect on the overall dynamics. It might have been in the center of the city, but think about that again when I show you some spatial dynamics.
Do you know where those various parishes are? Does that answer that question? Where are the parishes?
Oh, yes, we know it. Yeah, I'll come to that. Yeah, I can answer that question. Okay, so as a first cut at these questions, let's look at the epidemic curves, this number of deaths per week in the first few parishes that reported plague deaths. So here they are. And you can see that the mortality in the second parish that was infected is very delayed by several weeks compared to the first. And it's taking off when the other one is already declining. That's suggesting already that there was some spatial spread. But there's 130 parishes. This may have just been initially. If we plot on the same scale the aggregate curve, then, well, it's not obvious there was going to be spatial spread. We clearly need to look at the spatial data to figure this out. After plotting this, I thought, probably there was an initial move in, and then it started to mix up. To really get at it, we're going to have to look at the spatial dynamics. So let's do that. Okay, so how do we go about visualizing what happened spatially? So the first thing I'm going to do is show you a relatively simple-minded visualization. What we did was encoded the parish boundaries. I mean, there are maps from the time, and we can encode the parish boundaries of each of the 130 parishes in standard geographical information system format. And then I'm going to show you a visualization of as if it were an aerial view of the city, just coloring parishes as they became infected. And so here's the city. And I should say that the map that you can see underneath is a much more modern map, which I put on just so I could orient myself to London at the time, and I didn't have a good map of London at the time, so that there isn't actually dense population out here at that time. What you should keep in mind, though, is these parish boundaries, which are marked in red, are the boundaries of the parishes in question. The wall of London, it was a walled city at the time, is marked in yellow. This is the Thames River. This is London Bridge here. And so what I'm going to do now is, as I said, color the parishes in the sequence that they became infected, that is, the sequence in which they started reporting plague deaths, and ask yourself whether there's evidence for spatial spread or whether it mixes up or whatever. Okay, so it started well outside the walls of the city. So was there spatial spread? I think so. I think it's pretty convincing. There are certainly instances of where it seems to jump from one place to another, but that might have happened really because of people moving around or rats moving around, perhaps. But it also could have something to do with the fact that we're looking at deaths being reported, and you know, somebody could die before the person who infected them. Yeah.
What the criteria was for coloring?
Oh, yeah, sorry. OK, so parasites are colored with the same color if they were infected the same week. That's all.
This is the first incidence of reportage you get.
Absolutely, that's right. The first time you report a plague death, you get colored. And it's just a first cut to get a sense of whether there might have been spatial spread. And I think it's quite convincing in that way. And just a second before I answer your question, I'll just point out that at this point, interestingly, it had reached this parish, which is at the one side of the bridge, and it had reached this parish, which is by a major gate to the city. And the next week, it had crossed both both places, and then continues to encroach on the very center of the city over time. Yes?
On the very last iteration of that, there were a couple parishes inside the wall that never got a case.
Right. Yeah. Good question. So this is the Tower of London, where people were definitely dying sometimes, being executed, but they were not buried there. So there wasn't a parish church in which they would be buried elsewhere. So that's why that's empty. And this one, I forget what the reason for that is, but there's another region in the center where you wouldn't have expected anyone to be buried in that particular area.
Were these different colors a week apart? Or
mostly. At the very beginning, they're more than a week apart. Yeah. So the very big, but once we've covered, I forget, maybe 8 weeks, they're all a week apart. Yeah.
In these regions outside the wall, they're very sparsely populated.
Well,
right, or is there?
There are what you're seeing. So there are some very large parishes which are mostly rural, and there's probably a population center, which in some cases, in particular this first one, is quite large. But it wouldn't have been spread out over all that area, and that's actually something I'll come back to because I'd like to understand exactly what the population density was in these places, but I'm not sure of that yet. Yeah.
Did it come from somewhere, like on a ship from somewhere else?
Well, that's the theory for the Black Death back in the 14th century. If this was really the same disease, then you know it was in Europe and exactly we don't. I mean, the short answer is for this epidemic, I don't know how it made it to London in the first place. If the rat story is correct, then it would be endemic in rats all this time and just periodically blew up in humans. But why that should happen is an important question to try to answer.
Did you also look at the spatial spread of the peak? So you showed when the first death came about, and it was deemed a plague, but there's probably a larger error bar for whether it was plague or not.
Absolutely, especially at the beginning when there's a lot of evidence that people were afraid to say that their parish had plague.
Yeah.
Right, so those are problems. I will show you right now a different sort of visualization that gets at part of what you just asked. I could make the same plot at the peak of the different parishes, but I haven't done that. Exactly how you would interpret that would be something we'd need to discuss. So what that little visualization didn't show you was the magnitude of the epidemic in the different parts of the city at the various times. So not just for this particular epidemic, but motivated by doing a sort of work on a lot of other things, a couple of postdocs working with me developed some visualization software to enable us to look much more carefully at what happened. And this will allow us to look at the magnitude of the epidemic in each parish and visualize the whole spatial structure. So in order to do that, I will bounce out of PowerPoint for a second here. So this is our tool. And here now, you have the parish boundaries in white, the date is over here. You'll note that this goes up daily, and all we've done is simply interpolate it between the weeks just to get a smoother picture that doesn't go by as quickly. And you'll see that over time, cylinders rise, and the cylinders are in proportion to the per capita death from plague. So, oh, good question. How we normalize? It's normalized by the something proportional to the population size of that parish before the epidemic started. Maybe I'll let you watch this and then explain that detail afterwards. So now into June, you see that things are really taking off. And when things are really taking off in the big part of the epidemic, this is way after that whole period that you saw in the spatial spread picture. So there's a lot more detailed structure happening. And now it's basically over in 1665, but I find it easiest to look at it sideways like this. For a whole year after that epidemic was over, it continued to smolder in the city. This is very unusual, and that's something that we need to try to understand. How is it that it continued to smolder like that for a whole year after the peak of the epidemic? Yeah?
So those little bouncing things, how many deaths do they typically actually represent? Are we talking like one or tens or?
Yeah. Well, this is, I'll tell you what the what's being the height of the cylinder. I'll just play it again.
I understand that it's a per capita number, but there must be a sort of a typical parish size. I just want to get an idea of whether I'm seeing individual deaths there or whether it's higher numbers.
You're not seeing individual deaths, I don't think, where you can see it anywhere. There were lots of individual deaths in the first few months where you couldn't see anything on this plot. And if I change the scale, you'd see things happening early on. We could do this for hours to get different. Yeah.
The reason I was asking is, yeah, if those are all sort of tens of deaths, then it's a genuine sort of mini outbreak. Again, those little cylinders bouncing.
Right, I see. Okay. Potentially. Exactly. I mean, of course, because it's per capita, the meaning of the height in terms of absolute numbers is quite different in different places. And if I make the plot without doing it per capita, you get a very distorted picture of what happened. Okay. So, let's go back to this. Okay. So that was another visualization of this epidemic. So what are we doing with that? A variety of things. So using these data, and guided by the fact that we think there looks like there was a wave encroaching on the center, we can certainly quantify the speed of encroaching on the city, that sort of thing, and get a sense of, describe it in more precise mathematical or statistical terms. But more generally, we can try to simulate the overall structure of the dynamics of the epidemic using a computational model based on actually individuals living in all these different parishes and different routes of transmission, and ask questions about, well, for example, is it consistent with it being rat transmission? Or in general, do these data, together with various models, allow us to constrain the properties of the disease? Does it constrain the length of the infectious period or the latent period? Or the mixing pattern of the population? Any of those things would be useful to learn from these data. We're beginning that process. So I can't answer those questions right now, but you can certainly imagine that we can use the same kind of software to visualize simulations and also be much more careful about making comparisons between models and data. Okay, so one thing that we have done, which I'll be able to give you some kind of number on, is estimate the transmissibility of this pathogen, whatever it was. So I'll spend a few minutes talking about that. So what do we mean by the transmissibility of a pathogen? quantity that's of fundamental interest is called the basic reproductive ratio, or R naught. And that's the average number of secondary cases from a given primary case early in the epidemic. And I say early in the epidemic because it's defined at the time when everybody is susceptible, so at the time of introduction. Clearly, once most people have been infected or hardly anybody is left susceptible, the average number of secondary cases from a given case will be very small, and that won't be indicative of the nature of the pathogen. Okay. Well, this is the classic, and this is just a pure number. It probably does. It has, in a population that's, if you look at the same population, which has where all those things would influence in the same way, this is still a clear, useful number that allows you to compare.
So it being compared with different diseases, or?
Or the same pathogen sometimes under very, or in different circumstances could have different R naughts. Maybe ask why. In any case, this is a dimensionless number that characterizes the transmissibility of the pathogen. Yeah?
Just to ask the question in a different way. Is it the case, or can you assume, given that London was crowded enough, that everybody was exposed, and the fact that 20% of people died is a feature of those, that some individuals were susceptible and some individuals were not? Or is it a question of, did everybody get exposed?
Right. That's a good question. I guess some of what I'll say in the next couple of minutes might shed some light on that. All we know from the 20% having died, if that's the right number, is that gives us some kind of lower bound about the number of people who were actually infected. Well, it gives us a very good lower bound. But it could be that everybody was infected, or virtually everybody, or it could be that about 20% of the population was infected. But other aspects of estimating this might lead us to conclusions about that. So let me just follow on for a couple of minutes, and then probe me again. So the easiest way to measure this number in principle would be, even if you actually know who infected whom in the whole epidemic, you just count. And for the given epidemic, you'd be able to estimate that number in that way. But we never have that kind of data, and we certainly don't have it for the Great Plague of London. There are two classic ways of estimating this. One is that, as I'll show you, there's a classic formula that relates R naught, this reproductive number, to the final size of the epidemic, the proportion of the population that was infected. So if we can estimate the final size, then we can estimate R naught. It'll be difficult to estimate the number who are actually infected as opposed to who died in this particular case. And the other way is from the growth rate of the epidemic. Okay. Well, before we actually go on and do that, I'll just ask you for a guess of what you think this value, this number might be. And I know that you don't work in this field, so you wouldn't have any idea what the normal number would be. So here are a few diseases that you'll have some level of familiarity with, and at least one of which I'm sure you've all had. And what their R naughts are. So malaria is exceedingly transmissible, and it's estimated to be, well, big error bar there, but above 20. Measles and whooping cough around 15 or 17. Smallpox, much smaller, around 4, so much more weakly transmissible. Influenza, somewhere between 2 and 8, there's a big range because, as I'll come back to, newly invading strains of influenza tend to have weak transmissibility, and the ones that have been around for a long time tend to be more transmissible, as far as we can tell. And then something like SARS was actually very weakly transmissible. Again,
I would have thought that's well known.
It's very hard to estimate.
And just depends on the mosquito population.
Part of it is that it can vary because of the mosquito density in different places, but it's also just difficult to estimate what's happened in the malaria epidemic. Most of these estimates come from Africa. So where the data involved are not necessarily easy to interpret. So anyway, we could get into a long discussion of how you actually go about estimating these fractions.
What does it actually mean for malaria?
Pardon me?
What does it actually mean for malaria? I mean, it's not spreading directly from the primary cases to the secondary cases.
Right, so that's another subtlety. So, however, malaria is transmitted human to human via a vector.
Right.
Which is the mosquito.
Okay, so that's
an essential life stage in the vector in that case, unlike plague, for which there's no
right.
Essential. I shouldn't say that. There is an essential life stage for plague, but you can do without a flea in the case of plague, because it's pneumonic plague. It's still the case that because there's a chain among humans, and you can ask which humans actually were infected by this human. It's less straightforward to work it out, but it's a number you can define sensibly. Okay, so any guesses for the R-naught of the Great Plague of London?
50.
50?
5.
Somebody said pi?
No, I said high.
I said pi.
Not 2.14159.
Actually, keep pi there.
Okay. Might as well keep. Yeah. Yep. Five. Okay. Any other guesses?
15.
Questions, Craig. That's that one to ignore. 15, yeah. 100. Okay. Okay. Well, how do we go about estimating it? So I said the first way that we might try is via the final size of the epidemic. Okay, so this is going to lead to a disappointing lower bound. It turns out, and I won't derive it for you right now, it was derived a long time ago, there's in a very large class of epidemic models, actually Kermack and McCrendrick didn't know that it was how generally it applied, but you can show that there's a simple relationship between the proportion of the population that ends up being infected during an epidemic and this number R naught. Okay, you can solve that explicitly in terms of this, an unusual special function, but it's a little easier to look at in the implicit form. Yeah.
What's Z greater than or equal to? I thought you said Z was equal to 0.2.
No, because I know 20% of the population died. I don't know how many were actually infected. Many people may have recovered without dying. So all I know from the mortality data is that Z is bigger than about 0.2. And that gives me, well, a lower bound, 1.12 on R naught. Yeah.
I mean, this would seem to be a very sensitive function. If you plug in, 15, does that correspond to z equals to 1?
Yep.
So delta, so small error bars on d give huge error bars on R naught. Is that part of the problem?
That's certainly a problem for medium or large R naught. Yeah, and it's showing a limitation of this approach to estimating R naught. Still, we have a lower bound, 1.12 on R naught. Okay, so how else might we be able to estimate the epidemic? Nobody was close to 1.12, and our intuition would be that that's pretty small. But, and of course, you may have grasped that R naught has to be bigger than 1 if the disease is going to spread at all, because if it were less than 1, then that means on average the number of people getting infected is fewer in each generation and won't get growth.
Sorry, shouldn't there be a time scale in this formula? I mean, there is infinite time to kill everybody, you can have a very low reproductive rate. It happens in 1 week, it spreads very fast.
Right, but it turns out that this relationship doesn't depend on time. It turns out that well, maybe I'm just used to it. I don't find it strange in this case. I mean, what it's telling you is that you know, maybe there's something about the shape of epidemic curves that for pathogens that are transmitted in the ways we've envisioned that leads to this relationship. In any case, we could talk more about that after. How else might we estimate the transmissibility? So the other natural way to go at it is to estimate the growth rate of the epidemic at first, which must have something. There's a time scale there. And we can do that by estimating this, the exponential growth rate as the slope of the law of deaths, obviously. We can do that in the case that I'm talking about for each of the parishes, and then we're in trouble then about trying to estimate an error bar on this number. So one thing we can do is at least say, well, if we imagine that each of these were independent, then we can get some kind of error bar based on the growth in each of the parishes. If we do that, then we get this number. It's difficult to see how to get any kind of meaningful confidence interval on lambda, this growth rate, for an individual parish. If you have any ideas, I've asked all sorts of statisticians to have clever ideas about this and haven't had a good one.
Can I just write the formula that relates lambda to
our not? I'm about to. All I'm saying is this is a number that we can envision estimating from the data, the exponential growth rate from the epidemic curve. And we're in trouble, basically, if we want a genuine confidence interval on it. But let's go with that. Then we need to relate this lambda to R naught. OK. So in order to do that, we need some kind of model. The classic way to model infectious disease transmission is by dividing the population into several compartments, individuals who are susceptible, exposed, that is infected but not yet infectious, infectious or removed, so either dead or immune, so no longer epidemiologically relevant. If you do that, and you can write down a simple set of differential equations for this, or there are stochastic models, whatever, I can go over that in detail if people are interested after. Then it turns out that you can express R naught, the number you're after, in terms of the growth rate that you can estimate, in terms of the mean latent period, the mean time from infection to becoming infectious, and the mean infectious period of the pathogen. Yeah.
Sorry to go back, but there's another question about R naught.
Yeah.
Like, suppose that I have the disease, and I infect 3 people, and then they go and infect more people. Does the R naught just capture the number of people that I infected directly, or does it infect the total sort of amount of people that results from it?
Technically, it's defined in terms of what happens right at the beginning. So the average number that are infected, so if you imagine an ensemble of epidemics, the average number that are infected right at the beginning when everybody's susceptible. Unfortunately, that's a nice relationship, but we don't know the mean latent infectious period if we don't know what the pathogen is. We can measure from the data that I've shown you, we can estimate an exponential growth rate, but what do we do then? Okay, well, it turns out, this is something I spent a lot of time thinking about with Jun Ling, about how we can get beyond a particular model and try and get meaningful relationships here. And so turns out that very generally you can relate R naught to this exponential growth rate in terms of the Laplace transform of the serial interval distribution. So I talked about there's a latent period, there's an infectious period. The serial interval is the time from one case to the next infected case. And there's a distribution of that. You can express this in terms of that distribution. That's very useful. It's funny because we'd worked this out, and I happily mentioned this at a small meeting with other people who then told me that that they'd worked it out, and it was in press, which was a little disappointing, but still great to have this relationship. That allows us to say a little bit more from this estimated exponential growth rate. Okay, so we have time of infection and time of becoming infectious. And this is recovery, so no longer infection. Infectious, I guess you can't see that. But anyway, this is the infectious period. This is the latent period. The serial interval is neither, isn't, well, actually, there, in a special case, it would be just the sum of these two means, these two intervals. But in general, it is the time from somebody being infected to infecting somebody else. And so typically what happens is you're latent, and then after some time, you infect somebody else. And there's a distribution of those times between infection and the next infection. That's the serial interval. Okay. And it's something that you can express in terms of these distributions if you know them. But the serial interval is actually something that's often more practical to estimate than either of these. So it's actually a good thing to have that. Yes?
With people showing symptoms being isolated in hospital or something like that? Or they actually live at home and...
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
With people showing symptoms
being
quarantined or put in hospital?
Yes, that's a good question. So the practical infectious period might be shorter than what you measure just from somebody who is allowed to interact with others. Maybe that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Right, so you'd need to take that into account if you're trying to estimate. But and in the case of plague, it's potentially relevant because houses were actually boarded up when somebody was discovered to have plague, and they just kept everybody inside, which is a... And it's not clear what the effect of that was in terms of lengthening, because it probably meant everybody in that house then got infected, but maybe nobody else afterwards. It's a bit of a complicated story, but we'll try and make some progress without knowing those details. Okay, so we can go from the growth rate to the reproductive number. We have some idea from historical records what the range of latent periods and infectious periods might have been. And so if we have a look at two extreme cases, one where the latent and infectious periods are both exponentially distributed, and one where they're extremely narrowly distributed, almost the delta function, then the true distributions are probably somewhere between those. So based on that formula, we can convert our measured serial interval into an estimate of R0 based on the measured growth rate. And the measured growth rate is somewhere, say, between 15 on the top panels and 25 in the lower panels. And the upshot from all of this is that we can then, for the reasonable assumption that the serial interval was less than about 2 weeks, we get a very strong constraint on R0, and that is that it's less than 2. Okay? Very, very weakly transmissible. Moreover, if we make the assumption that it wasn't just any pathogen, but it was specifically Yersinia pestis, and it was specifically pneumonic plague, the human-to-human transmissible form, then we know from more modern epidemics what the latent and infectious periods are, and then we get R0 equals 1.3. Okay? This was very, very weakly transmissible. And so the upshot from all of that is that although this was such a devastating epidemic, it seems to have been caused by something that was very weakly transmissible. And in fact, if you remember the numbers that I threw out a few minutes ago, similar in transmissibility to the 1918 flu or to SARS, which were both actually very weakly transmissible. And so there is a lesson that I think keeps coming up from everything we're able to make these estimates from. And that's that newly invading pathogens often seem to be very weakly transmissible. Yet they're often the worst.
The formula for the size of the epidemic, what does this 1.3 translate to? Is it death rate?
OK. Sorry, I just finished my thought, which is that although, so you might be, it might seem bad that you've got a newly invading pathogen. Don't be fooled by it being weakly transmissible. They could be the most important. On the other hand, if it's true that most new pathogens are weakly transmissible, we do have a better chance of stopping them from spreading, as we did with SARS. Okay, so that's encouraging. If you plug in 1.3 into that formula, you actually get something very close to 20%. And that's very interesting, because pneumonic plague is almost always fatal. And so if it really was pneumonic plague, then it could be that really we're seeing most of the actual infection in the death records. And so that's a kind of consistency argument. It still doesn't prove anything. But we're not, I'm certainly not after all this rushing out to claim that it wasn't Yersinia pestis. Yes?
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure what the range of parameters mean here, but it seems to me that you do a lot of variation of parameters, and yet R naught is always around 2 or 3. So if you wanted to produce R naught in the hundreds, for example, that would seem to be extreme case, unless I'm not quite interpreting this the right way.
Well, this is R naught. These numbers are based on measuring a specific growth rate. For a much higher R naught, you'd be measuring a much higher growth rate.
Well, and would be much larger.
Yeah, that's right.
And also, the latent period is very important, right? I mean, if you're carrying something and nobody knows, that's really integrating the period that you'll be in contact with people.
Well, the latent period, you're not infectious. So there's also another distinction.
But SARS is 2 weeks, so we knew that. That's why people need to be by themselves, to keep to themselves before they start interacting with people. So the latent period should be a parameter.
Well, as I argued, in fact, the latent period itself isn't directly relevant, as it happens, to your estimate of R naught from the growth rate, because it's embedded in this serial interval distribution. That's why I. So I mean, on this side, in the particular extreme case of exponentially distributed distributions, the serial interval is the sum of the latent period and the infectious period. So it's there. It's not so easy to write down in the other case.
You actually try to unravel it, right, from knowing that T total plus T in infectious to get back to the R0. That's what you set off to do?
What I wanted to do was estimate R0 based on an estimate of lambda, the exponential growth rate. In order to do that, what I mentioned was that there's this nice formula by Willinga and Lipsitch that shows that there's a simple relationship between the serial interval distribution, it's the Laplace transform, and R naught. So if you plug in the exponential growth rate into that formula and you know the serial interval distribution, you get an estimate for R naught. So if you vary the serial interval distribution, as I've done in these two extreme cases, you get a window on R naught. Yeah. And I'll just finish that thought. I'm starting to go over time. In practice, there's an important period between when you become infectious and when you show symptoms. And then, so the incubation period is the time between infection and when you start becoming infectious. And that's critical. This period is critical if you're going to try and control. In the case of SARS, the incubation period and the latent period seem to be about the same. There was no evidence for transmission before symptoms showed. That made it a lot easier to control. But that's another issue. OK. So this is supposed to end at 3 o'clock. So I'm going to jump.
We've asked a lot of questions. And we're used to going past the hour substantially when there are a lot of questions.
Okay, all right, so.
We'll tell you when it's too much.
Okay. All right, now I'll just continue with what I was going to say. Okay, so as you know, we've got some estimate for this exponential growth rate for each of the parishes. Well, can we learn anything by looking at all those different parishes? Well, one thing you might imagine, depending on what your hypothesis is that the size of the epidemic might be related to your estimate of the growth rate. There's no apparent relationship between these two quantities. Okay, what else? Well, another thing that we can estimate is the time at which the epidemic started in each of the parishes, and relate that to our exponential growth rate. Well, this isn't a relationship. This is actually a significant relationship. It's funny, this was a physicist would never think this could be significant. But biologists can be very impressed by this. But in any case, it's funny because I remember when working in astrophysics, I was talking about it. Is it three sigma detection or something? I this is not a three sigma detection of anything, but if you ask yourself, is there, in standard statistical terms, a relationship here? There is with a.
What? This is P naught relative to the Big Bang or P naught.
Okay. T naught relative. We start time when the very first reported plague test occurred, and then we can ask what relative to that, what, how far along, and this is in years, did it start in various parishes, and then we ask, okay, let's plot against that our estimated exponential growth rate. Okay, is there a relationship? Well, there's. For a physicist, an extremely weak relationship with a p-value of 0.002. For a biologist who's happy with 0.05, that's a pretty strong relationship. And of course, we could argue for a long time about what we should attribute anything to. But what's more relevant here is that it's a relationship that explains 22% of the variance that you see. If you ask, okay, well, it's clearly not the whole story. What if we do a multiple regression and we could start playing a lot of games with this? If we ask, which is the next thing we asked, what about relating it also to the baseline deaths, by which I mean the average death in a given parish over the previous years, which relatively speaking is a marker of population size? Well, that starts to explain about half the variance that you see in the relationship, and then if I could make an appropriate plot, the points in question would be quite close, and you might be more comfortable even as a physicist. Okay, what can we say just from this statistical relationship? I think it's suggesting that there's a relationship, as you might expect, between population density and R naught. But without actually having detailed density information on these parishes, I can't really say that for sure. We're in the process of trying to gather some data about distribution of households and so on in the various parishes in order to try and get at that better. We'll see if that holds up, but I think it's suggestive. Okay. Do we know what the pathogen is? I don't know. I made a plausibility argument maybe that it might could have been pneumonic plague, but to really get at it, we'd like to sequence the pathogen. Can we do that? Well, I have a colleague at McMaster, Hendrik Poynar, who's a specialist in ancient DNA. You may have heard about some of his work sequencing part of the woolly mammoth genome, which was a big deal a couple of years ago. And together, we're trying to, that's primarily his work, he's a specialist in that area, trying to answer that by actually looking at skeletons, teeth from plague victims, and seeing if we can sequence pathogen. And it turns out that bacteria are well preserved in skulls, in the teeth, and he's done this in many instances. So we will soon be going to London and we've got permission to dig in the existing plague pits that I've identified as useful places to look from the data that you've seen. We'll see what that turns up. They have already sent some teeth from a museum in London. So I'm not sure what was stated on the. But what we're talking about is fragments of DNA that can then be matched up to the pathogen. There is no worry that there's living bacteria in the teeth. So I don't think it would genuinely be a concern. And in fact, the major concern when you're doing this work is contaminating the DNA with something that's got nothing to do with what you're trying to find. So there are other important questions that I haven't addressed at all. You know, why was there this pattern of temporal pattern of plague epidemics before 1666? And something that I didn't mention at all, there's no record of plague after 1666. Why did it suddenly go extinct after the Great Plague? What was that pathogen? Well, we don't know, but hopefully we'll get some closer answers in the near future. Okay, I've talked almost all about plague and the Great Plague of London. If you want me to go on for another 3 minutes, perhaps? Yeah, I'll just mention some work that's going on with other data, and I'll just mention very quickly. So we've got tuberculosis, which is listed as consumption. This is weekly mortality over a very long period, from 1665 to 1830 for the moment. And there's an annual oscillation in tuberculosis deaths, which I suspect actually has not a whole lot to do with tuberculosis in this case. It's probably just to do with the fact that mortality varies annually. But we don't know that for sure yet. But we wouldn't expect any particular signature on the scale of 1 year with tuberculosis because of the nature of the disease. Still, comparing this pattern of death with the demography of the time may be something that we can understand better using infectious disease models for tuberculosis. And I have a postdoc who's beginning to think about that. No, I'll show you another Fourier transform in a minute. The Fourier transform isn't exciting for this because there's just a lot of power at 1 year and nothing else.
These are raw deaths, not per capita, right?
That's correct.
So it's declining per capita because the population is going up, right?
Approximately declining.
Or not, I don't know.
It's not as dramatic as you'd think here, but yeah, there's a counterbalance effect. These are just the raw data. You're absolutely right. I'm making no attempt to. I'm just indicating there are some other interesting problems here. So another example is whooping cough. Again, this is weekly whooping cough. I'm sure that early on, identifying whooping cough was a problem, and that this is basically just noise. But eventually, they became better at it, I presume. And when you look at more detailed structure here, there's a little bit more going on. There seems to be some change in the period between epidemics. But again, we're just beginning to look at this. Something that we've looked at much more carefully so far, one of my students, Olga Krylova, is doing this work, is smallpox epidemics. And here you see weekly smallpox from 1664 up to 1880. And even at a glance here, you see that there is some obvious change in the frequency of epidemics. So you can't, without careful analysis, you won't be able to tell by eye what the period here is, but it's not changing too much. But the character changes enormously in this region, which is, interestingly, the time of beginning of variolation when they started giving people basically smallpox scabs, hoping that that would prevent them from getting infecting them from smallpox scabs intentionally, hoping that would prevent them from getting genuine smallpox. Fortunately, often they often died then. But in this period, vaccination for smallpox was introduced. And the character of the epidemic has totally changed because the frequency is much lower. And if you do a wavelet transform, then you can see this a little bit more clearly. if you're used to looking at this sort of diagram. So this is showing basically a power spectrum at each moment in time. And the dominant power in bright red is about 2.5 or 3 years for most of this period, but then later on it starts getting much larger, probably over 4 years. Now, that is something that we can address very well using mathematical models of infectious disease transmission. And this is something that I've done a lot in the past with 20th century data for childhood diseases like measles and mumps and rubella and whooping cough, in order to be able to predict why there were these changes in frequency of epidemics. So, for example, for measles, we were able to predict that when the vaccination started, it induced a bifurcation that caused a change from one epidemic structure to another. And I'm pretty confident at this point that that's what we'll be able to show here. That analysis of a nonlinear dynamical model that I could easily write down for you will allow us to predict that because of changes essentially in the effective R naught that are induced by vaccination or variolation, we can predict a change in the frequency of epidemics. And by doing that, it'll give us a lot more confidence that we really understand what's behind these epidemic patterns. OK, I'll just mention briefly, but not show it until questions if anybody is interested, that on a different line, I've just yesterday managed to get this working for something that some data that I managed to collect while on sabbatical at Cornell last year, which is daily mortality in New York State in each county during the 1918 flu pandemic. So that might whet your appetite a bit. And we can look at that after if you like. And I'll just say in general that I hope that this discussion has convinced you that historical infectious disease mortality data have a lot to tell us. We can learn a great deal from them. About what happened in the past, both epidemiologically and ecologically, infer things about ecological systems now, and infer things that allow us to make better epidemiological models, develop better control strategies for pathogens that are extant now or may visit us in the future. And part of this project is that I've set up a website where all of these data will eventually be available. In a convenient format. I encourage you to go there and download some data and do some work in this area if you're interested. So on the Great Plague specifically, I'll emphasize again that it was very devastating, clearly, yet it was caused by a pathogen that appears to have been very weakly transmissible, and that seems to be a recurrent theme. In addition, it has some small-scale spatial structure that you saw, especially in that first visualization, some spatial spread, which is very unusual for us to see in epidemic data. So that's very interesting, and we hope to understand that in great detail using mathematical and computational models in the future. So finally, I should thank the agencies that have funded this work, and thank you for your attention. And if you know anybody who's interested in the postdoc working on this kind of stuff at McMaster, please let me know.
A few more questions here, just a couple more questions, and then David was around for the rest of the day to chat informally.
Yeah, I was wondering if this thing with the transmissibility has implications for the evolutionary study of these patterns. I mean, if the highly devastating ones are slowly,
Yeah, so, and that's something I didn't talk about, but it is something that we're looking into, which is whether R naught itself evolves over time. So, I mean, it would appear, at least one argument that I would make with respect to influenza, for which we have all sorts of data, is that newly invading pandemic strains come in very weakly transmissible. And you can make all sorts of arguments for why they might be weakly transmissible. But then, in order to persist, they need to become more transmissible. And some of the work that we're doing, which I didn't discuss does seem to corroborate that idea. So whether I can't say that we have a good mathematical model that explains it very well right now, but we're working on it, and I hope we'll make good progress on that in the coming years. Yeah.
I guess one main point you presented here is that the R0 is just pathogen dependent. I'm trying to understand how you got that. For example, I asked the question latent period dependent, and certainly population density, right?
Right, so the latent period is something that is associated with the pathogen.
That's right.
Whereas the population density is not. Both would contribute to R0. Yeah.
So how come R0, when you present that list, there's no population density parameter, like Mararius 100, SARS 2?
Right, and some of the variation in malaria probably is due to variation in density in the regions where it was estimated.
Right.
SARS occurred in very limited environments. There may be a population density effect there, but the sorts of estimates that we have, I don't think are going to resolve that.
But related to the population density is also the natural effect of this.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Related to this, shall we say, extrinsic factor, okay. There's actually other factors that enter how effectively one could examine whether certain population is exposed. This we know from SARS, right, back not even one decade ago, and how well the government, exercised quarantine and all that, right? So my question is that R0 should have parametric dependence on these factors. Is that true or not?
Yeah, absolutely. The goal of a control program is to reduce R0 below 1. The effective R0. But when we talk about R0, we're talking about the intrinsic number as it would spread if you weren't using any control measures. But and if you monitor the reproductive number, which you wouldn't just call R0, over time, in the presence of interventions, then you can have sudden changes because everybody's using barrier precautions or because of quarantine or whatever. And you can look at the effects of these different control strategies and how much effect they have on R0. Under various circumstances.
So the list you presented were historical data, right, which of course vary in how well people can control that.
Yeah, those were all the estimates that I listed were estimates of R0 in circumstances where there was no control going on.
Thank you.
And let me just emphasize, because it seems like we have a lot of detailed questions, and maybe the thing to do is to let the discussion continue. Let's thank David now, and then let's continue with those people who want to have a detailed discussion. Okay.